Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great pleasure to have with us Jean Lemierre. He's been in London for 2 years, which is longer than he should have been before he came to visit us and talk to us here. He is, as I think many of you know, the perfect, I can say this, I think, the perfect French civil servant, which means he's not only very clever and effective, but actually he's very broad-minded as well. He started off in the ENA as so many of the best people did. He rose through the tax service, became head of the tax service, then head of the treasury, when he was very involved in international economic affairs and was chairman of the Paris Club, among other things. 2 years ago, he came to run the EBRD, which is, of course, an extremely important institution for the future of Europe, but goes much beyond that and reaches as far as the Pacific. And today he's going to talk about that little bit in between Europe and the Pacific, not Russia, but the other bit, which we used not to think about very much, but has come to all our attention in recent years, which is the area of Central Asia. So we're really looking forward to being illuminated on this mysterious region. John.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your comments. And maybe later you will tell me what is a perfect French civil servant. It's maybe not so much a model. I'm very happy to be here. It's good to see you. And, some faces I know, and this is very pleasant. I have to apologize for my English because I have a flu, so it may be difficult for you, not for me, but for you. Central Asia. The focus has been put on Central Asia a few months ago for very unfortunate reasons, which is the 11th of September. And the chief economist of the bank, he has disappeared. William has disappeared. No, William is here. Has said at that time, the most important thing I would like to repeat to you is there's the news there. Now everybody knows where is Central Asia. And I think this is very important. And may I say that this is my opening remark. This is also my conclusion. We shouldn't forget Central Asia. Now we know what it is. There is a window of opportunity. We shouldn't forget where is Central Asia. Why the focus has been put on Central Asia? Mainly for two reasons, you know. And what I'll try to do this evening is maybe to explain what are the challenges we see for the region, and short way, what we, BRD, we try to do for the region. I would simply, to start by one point, the EBRD is the, which is not known, the single biggest investor in the region. We are more important than the Asian Development Bank. We are more important than private sector. We are the biggest investor in the region. So the bank has got now 10 years experience in, and knows quite well the region. The two main focus in the last period have been, for the first one, the regional security. It's clear that this region is, well, I shouldn't say this here. Kipling has called this region, you remember this, the Great Game. It's the region between Russia and the South. At that time, it was India. But Pakistan was India. Afghanistan was not so far. That was the place of the Great Game. And it is maybe still the case. And the regional security questions, of course, are crucial, taking into account the situation in Afghanistan, but not only. And I will come back on this point later. The second focus was about resources. The resources, the energy resources in this region are huge. And they are a potential means for creating new sources of supply, maybe for the United States, but mainly for Europe. And it's probably an anchor for regional cooperation. Before I try to explain what are the challenges we see in the region, maybe I should say, what is the region? I hope you know it, but it's maybe safer to remind you a few facts on the region. The region is as vast as Europe, Western Europe, our Europe. But there are only 50 million people. It's the largest region landlocked in the world. And this is part of the problem. This region has had very few contacts with the other parts of the world after the 17th century. Before that, you had the Silk Road. But since the 17th century, there was very, very few contacts. This is a region where you have many religions, but you have no tradition of radical Islam. But this is a region where you have many, you have Nestorian, you have Buddhist, you have Zarathustra, you have, it's a very, very buoyant region from that point of view, but it's quite an open region. This region is certainly the newest energy region in the world. The total proven reserve of oil in the region are probably 15 billion barrels of oil, and it could be increased. Probably up to 40 billion barrels, simply for oil. It's a huge province for gas. The Turkmen reserves are the third largest in the world, around 3 trillion, how do you say in English? Well, I meant cube, you have understood. Cubic, yeah. Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan have both 2 trillion cubic meters. These are huge reserves of gas. Except this, there's not a lot. Agriculture. Cotton, with a disaster. Pollution, the Aral Sea. That's the black aspect of the region. What is the political tradition of the region? Let's be clear, and this is part of the problem. There's no antecedents to Western democratic tradition. You have had the Cannes system and then the USSR, to make it very short. But you have no Western democratic tradition, and this is once more part of the difficulty. What are the challenges we see for the region? We see mainly three challenges. The first one is to try to answer to the problems created by the geographic location of Central Asia. And it's clear that what they need is to improve transportation and to improve their regional market. And I will come back to this question. The second challenge is the improvement in the efficiency of the use of their resources. It means a sound macroeconomic policies to neutralize the impact of the oil wealth, especially in a country like Kazakhstan. It means reduction in domestic energy waste. It means the creation of a sound investment climate to attract foreign investment. What for? To build an economy which is not only oil-based. And this is part of our duty to try to do this. And I mentioned the last one in the use of their resources, they have to improve the management of the water resources. And this is the regional angle. It's easy in the region. You have water in Tajikistan, in Kyrgyzstan. You have no water in Uzbekistan, in Turkmenistan. And the water question is becoming a crucial one and very difficult. The third challenge they have is to promote political reforms to strengthen their governance. It means fight against corruption, that's clear. It means more accountability of the government to the interests of the population. And it means a very strong commitment to build sound institutions, and they have to build everything. 10 years after their independence, and this is crucial, they are very young states. They were a part of the USSR, and they have had only no experience of independence. 10 years after their independence, what is the judgment we can have on what they have done? I think I'll be as clear as possible. The feeling we have in the bank is that it's positive, but still these 10 years has brought mixed progress. And there are still a lot to be done. What is one of the elements of the region is, yes, there has been progress in economic, progress in politics circles, but unfortunately, there are still a lot of protectionism. And one of the difficulties of the region is to be a region. You look at Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan has a very specific exchange rate system. And this exchange rate system kills the investment. They have a dual system. Turkmenistan, the same. Kazakhstan has created trade barriers after 1998. When you know Kyrgyzstan, where are the markets of Kyrgyzstan? They are in Kazakhstan or they are in the eastern part of Siberia, but they must cross Kazakhstan. Where can Tajikistan sell its water? To Uzbekistan. Let's be clear, we have put money in a company in Tajikistan. We thought it was a good idea to support the company. They put water in bottles. That's very good. The company can be viable only if they are able to sell the bottle of water in Uzbekistan, which is obvious. No? The problem is that there's a border. That's all. And the trucks don't cross the border, or it's very difficult. That's part of their problem. What do I mean? I mean simply that the potential of regional market remains underexploited. And this is still a big problem, and they have to improve this situation. I'll come back to this because we try to help them to do it. Second point, there are still many reforms to be done in the energy sector. Just to avoid waste of energy, they have to address questions like the tariff policies and the affordability problems, which is being done in Kazakhstan, but still a problem, especially in Uzbekistan. They have been quite successful in attracting foreign direct investment in the oil and gas sector for obvious reasons. They have also to attract foreign direct investment in the rest of the economy. And they are moving forward, but especially in Kazakhstan, where it is quite good, but in a country like Turkmenistan, they have still a lot of progress be done to be able to meet the normal criteria they should have to enjoy a growth. The other problem, I've already mentioned it, is water management. Water management is certainly one of the key questions of the region. There's a huge imbalance between Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan on one hand, and the other countries, especially once more Uzbekistan. And it's probably one of the most dangerous question for the stability of the region. How do they succeed to manage these water resources and allocate it in a normal way between the various countries? So water is key. But I have kept the last point for its democracy. And let's be clear, there is a problem in this region about democracy. I said that democracy was not known, the European democratic standards were not known in the region. They work on them in most of the countries. We have a specific concern on one country, which is Turkmenistan. And this question has a strong link with their capacity to attract foreign direct investment. What do we try to do? And of course, you will see that I'll try to address, to show to you how we do address their problems. Well, you know the mandate of the EBRD is to promote market economy and democracy. We do believe that the two go together. And we try to invest mainly in the private sector. We are project-oriented, but we have a policy dialogue to be able to build the projects. And we try to help them to attract foreign investors. Once more, we are the single largest investor in Central Asia. We have invested, you will see, it's not a lot of money, but we are the biggest, so you see the problem. We have invested $1.8 billion American dollar in the region, which is a lot of money for the region, but the needs are certainly higher. We are focused on the private sector. Nearly 60% of the amount I've given to you are invested in the private sector. What do we do? SMEs, you have to create a whole sector of SMEs that don't exist today, and they have to be developed. For two reasons, economic reasons and democratic reasons. We have to try to attract foreign direct investment. We have been investing quite a lot of greenfield investment in the region, especially in Kazakhstan and in Uzbekistan, which are the two main countries which can attract foreign direct investment. We have put in place trade facilitation program to try to develop external trade, but also internal trade in the region. We try to support their needs in infrastructure, especially in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, transport, railways, airports, municipal environments, and so on. That moment, we see that what is the, after the 11th of September, what can we say about what we try to do and about the situation of the region? And I would like to make four personal remarks. The first one is, maybe in the past, we have not paid enough attention to the region. We have thought that it was rather easy for these countries, some of them are rich, they have gas and oil, they were Republic of the USSR, to become independent states, behaving normally. They have become independent. Two of them, three of them are rich, but it is still very difficult, and we should support them more. But I would like to mention two countries, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. These countries are among the poorest countries in the region and in the world. They are highly indebted. Tajikistan has had the most awful civil war, mid-90s. And I'm not so sure that we have paid enough attention to this situation. And there is a new momentum on the region. There has been a very important conference in London, Lancaster House, last week, about the poor CIS countries, and with a specific commitment of the British authorities, especially on Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. The Paris Club begins to look at their situation and will try to do something. That's very positive. And I think we mustn't forget this. Probably we haven't paid enough attention except to their needs in or to their resources in gas and oil, but that's not enough. It's clear also that the more peaceful situation in Afghanistan is a better situation for them. They have suffered quite a lot from the potential tough Islamic movements in the region, and especially Uzbekistan has been very protectionist and has tried to protect himself against this. And once more in Tajikistan, they have had a civil war. I think 80,000 people killed, which is not known. It's under the monitoring of the UN now, but it's a very difficult situation. The second point I would like to mention is the role of Russia. Yes, today we look more at them, but Russia is the neighbor, Russia is the partner, and will always be. And if you want to develop, when you are, I hope you have been there, or you will go, but when you are in Almaty, or in Astana, or when you are in Tashkent, and you think about creating a company, and you want to export, where do you want to export? To Siberia and to Russia. And if I say this, it's because I believe that it would be crucial that W negotiation, especially for Kazakhstan, be done at the moment it is done for Russia. Not before and not later. The fact that they belong to the same trade and investment area is very important. And the attitude of Russia and the partnership with Russia is crucial. You know, now I'll go to my third short remark. There is a country which is very important when you are there, but silent today. It is China. China is the neighboring country, the other one, the big one. They have gas. China needs energy for the development of the western part of China. And some of these countries, like Tajikistan, have a dream, which is to sell electricity to China. I don't know if this dream will become real one day. I don't know this. But they begin to look at China, which is the other big country, neighboring country. If I mention China, it's because there is an organization which is not well known. It's what is called Shanghai Five, which has been created a few years ago by China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan. And now it's like the G7, becomes the G8. It's Shanghai 5 plus 1 because Uzbekistan has joined. What does it mean? What's the basis of this? It's security questions, looking at the south, Afghanistan. But there is an organization. They meet quite often at the level of the heads of state. The Chinese and the Russian are very active. And it's clear that something is happening there. We don't know exactly what it is, but it does exist. And it's very important for them. When I meet with the heads of state of the region, they talk a lot about this. Why? Because they have Russia and China on board. Once more, security reasons, but probably tomorrow, trade and trade agreements. My final comment will be about the window of opportunity. There is a window of opportunity after the 11th of September. There is a real one. They have taken major decisions. They have been very open to, it was their interest, but they have been very open, and Russia has been very open to the use of their airspace and sometimes territory for the war in Afghanistan. They are more open to the West. They want to be to have a dialogue with the West. What we hope in the bank is that this window opportunity will not be missed. It means dialogue. It means investment. There are very good opportunities for investment in the region, in various sectors. It means political dialogue, and not only security or military dialogue. And that's new, and it is not very well known. It means the allocation of resources to build projects in the region. I prefer not to tell you what was the budget of TC funds allocated by the EU in the region. Nearly nothing. So we have a window of opportunity. It's difficult for them to be more open. It is their interest. We have to do our best, all of us, to be sure that this region will be more open, will promote a dialogue with us, will promote democratic reforms, economic reforms, and will be able to be sustainable in itself. And that means, that would be my last sentence, that means better coordination among themselves, which is not the case today. But that will not come only from themselves. That will come from our capacity to talk, invest, dialogue with them. the challenge is huge. Never forget that part of that region was the route of the drug from Afghanistan. So we have a real challenge. They have resources. They are the core, what you have said, between Europe and the Pacific. They are very open-minded, oriented toward the West. The president of Kazakhstan has said to me not long ago, never forget that we are European, I said to him, president. He said, never forget, you know, Attila was coming from there. And it's friendly. It's not a threat. It means we share the same continent. We share the same history. We share the same challenges. Maybe we can share the same gas. And that's certainly the interest of the European countries. Maybe we could share the same oil. We need to have a dialogue with them. We cannot say to them, no, you are not allowed to export your gas or your oil through Iran or through Afghanistan to go to Asia, but to go through the West. And the West means two routes, and simply two routes, Russia or the Caucasus. But that should be the theme of another discussion, which is the Caucasus, because Caucasus is a very difficult region, but is in between us and them to export gas. And it's a difficult story. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. If that's your English when you have flu, I think it's a good comment on your English, but also on the real interest of what you said. We've got quite some time for questions. Who would like to start off? Perhaps I'll start. I want to ask about human capital, which I know is not the prime function for the EBRD, but of course it's physical capital can't work without it. And I wondered first how much of a constraint you perceive that for business development in Central Asia, and two, if the West is really doing what it should do about it. My perception was in the Russian case that they didn't, and the World Bank, whose main responsibility it was, really largely failed, both on the management training front and on the training of lower level people. Failed to organize a massive overseas training for really top-level people in the way that the Chinese went in for, and failed at the lower level to organize really effective cascade systems of training of technicians, secretaries, and so on. I happen to have strong views on this because you may know my wife organized a good cascade system for secretaries, but there were very few cascade training systems organized in Russia, and it was easy to see what could be done. Can you tell us how much is being done and how much of a problem it is?
Well, we can use the word human capital, and don't like this very much. But the skills of the people are very high. They are very well trained. If you talk about engineers, technicians, they are very good. That's mainly the tradition of the USSR. The problem is that they are specialists. In Uzbekistan, the best people are specialists of aircraft industry, because Stalin had put the plans to build the aircraft in Uzbekistan. It was far from, you know, Stalingrad. So if you meet the older generation, that's their training. But they are very, very well trained. The problem, it's the case everywhere in the former USSR, it's the training to managerial questions. But the young generation is good. In Uzbekistan, especially in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, they are very well trained in languages, very well trained in business. We have quite a lot of them in the bank, because we recruit and train them, and I can tell you they are really good. So you have very good people there. The problem is not so much this one, and you have very good people to work in everywhere. There is one country where there is a little problem. Well, there is a problem. It's Turkmenistan, because some Turkmen tend to leave the country for obvious reasons, democratic reasons. But otherwise, the quality of the people is very high, very good. And they know how to do. What they don't have, really, is how to organize a bank, how to organize a trade relationship, how to... That's the reason why we need to work with them and help them. That's true for Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, and probably Kyrgyzstan. In Tajikistan, you have a very specific problem. And the problem in Tajikistan comes from the fact that during the last years, unfortunately, drug traffic has been the main business. It's in the route between Afghanistan and Europe. It went through Tajikistan. And there, unfortunately, it has given certain habits to certain people. You know. And that's a problem in Tajikistan. And the UN is working hard on that. But mainly, my point of view is that the quality of the people is good. They need to train them more to managerial techniques, but they are good. And they want to succeed. That's very clear.
Next question.
The EBRD's portfolio in the region, you were saying, was $1.8 billion. How much do you see that portfolio increasing to during, let's say, the next year or 2 years? And as a proportion of the EBRD's budget, what sort of changes do you expect?
Last year was probably one of the biggest year of investment in the region. We have invested roughly $350 million a year. I think that, well, my answer will be in two parts. I think as far as volume is concerned, because you are talking about volume, we should do probably that as an average a year, which is a challenge, because you need to have good projects. And mainly, if not, not in the oil and gas sector, because money goes in the oil and gas sector. We have nothing to do there. But to try to help them to build infrastructures, private companies, and SMEs and banking sector. We are investing a lot now for leasing companies and so on. The second part of my answer is about some projects. We have made a change in the policy we have had. We tend to increase the resources we allocate to rather small projects from your point of view. Let's say $500,000 or $1 million, what we call the DIF, which is the investment in equity in small operations, small companies in countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Because what we need to do there is to take a bigger risk on small projects, which has a huge impact on the economy, to create companies and the market economy. They don't exist. And for instance, in Kyrgyzstan, we are putting money on a company, a cotton company. It's a Portuguese company working there, and we put money there to try to restart the activity. These are small projects. The volume is very limited. The risk is very high. But this is our job to do it. So we have now a new focus on rather small projects, SMEs, loans, and equity investment in rather small companies from your and our point of view, but they are very important in the region. So the average for me should be probably $350, $400 million a year. You know, the implementation capacity is limited. So you shouldn't pour too much money, because then it could create difficulties. But this, plus specific focus on the small business. But to answer your point about how important it is for us, it is very important. If you want my personal comment on this, is it's not a lot of money compared to our annual commitment. But it's a lot of the resources, the human resources of the bank, to build the projects. Because it's more difficult to build a project there than in Poland or in the Czech Republic.
Thank you. Next one.
if you believe that geography does matter for development, could you sketch a scenario of, say, 10 years from now, if everything went well, what sort of economy do you visualize that could be there? You know, it's all very well to say market. What would be the productive base of the economy, besides being just exporters of oil? Perhaps another way to do it would be to give another example anywhere else in the world where they have successfully negotiated or addressed the development constraints you're talking about. Because if you can do that, I can sketch a negative scenario.
What we see, it's quite easy. What we see is a development based on their assets, oil and gas, with a sound management of the revenue coming from gas and oil. And for them to be able to build a normal, diversified economy. But it will go through a regional cooperation. And that doesn't exist today. When we try to attract an investor, I'll take you an example. Try to attract an investor to build refrigerators. You can. We know companies. Turkish companies, they are ready to invest there. But they hesitate to go there for a market of 20 million or 15 million people. They would be ready to go for a market of 15 or 50 million people. And that's part of the problem. That's a real big problem. That's the water problem. That's the you can develop the problem of the service industry. You can develop in this 50 million market people, based on the wealth of oil and gas, a rather normal internal market. Don't forget that you have Siberia. And Siberia is developing fast, once more, because of gas. And Siberia must buy food and so on somewhere. The closest region is Kyrgyzstan. So you have the possibility in the broad region on the revenue, gas and oil, to build quite a good economy. But it is very, they must be aware that this is the challenge, and we try to promote regional cooperation there. And it is not yet totally the case. Some of the leaders of the region are much in favor of this. President of Kazakhstan is much in favor of the opening of the countries on improving trade. So if you want to take model, I don't know if there's a model. There's certainly one, which is Norway, the capacity to manage the revenue coming from gas and oil in a sound way and clever way, not to waste it, you know, not to build armed forces and so on, but to manage it in the long term for a sustainable development. Norway is a good example. And countries like Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, which is not in Central Asia, looking a lot at what Norway is doing. And then the other model is certainly the opening of the borders and trade.
EBRD is the only international financial institution with a political mandate. Given the delicate nature of relations with the administrations in the region, I was wondering how the EBRD is dealing with these countries on that front. And my second question is, with most of Central and Eastern Europe are progressing fast in transition process, do you see the future role of EBRD more focused on regions like Central Asia and the Caucasus?
Thank you to pay some attention to the EBRD. On the first point, yes, we make an assessment about the political democratic situation each 2 years. It's an assessment, it's published, it's a decision by the board of the bank, and it's on the website. We have a concern today, and when I say concern, I use a diplomatic word. We have a concern about Turkmenistan. We have taken a position about Turkmenistan, which is to nearly stop. We have stopped all of our operation in the public sector. We have maintained the capacity to make operation in the private sector, but there's nearly none. I have written to Turkmenbashi a few months ago to try to set, give him certain points by which we thought, targets he should meet for us to be able to restart more activity. I'm still waiting for the answers. And we shall review the situation mid-year this year. Among the targets, it's clear that there is one element which is key for me, is the effective possibility to implement the SME program. Once more, we make a very, very strong link between SME and democracy. The capacity to be an entrepreneur, the capacity to vote is nearly the same. And when we see a country in which we have a program, we have money, but because of various elements, the money is not disbursed, is not used, there's a problem. You know what I am being told when I try to explain this to the country? But there are speculators. Speculator is the old word in the USSR for businessmen. But you see, and so we have quite a tough dialogue. We have today a very tough dialogue with two countries in the region, Turkmenistan and Belarus. The same situation in Belarus. The reasons are different, but situation is the same. On the second point, you have a second question about, your question was about future of Central Europe, the future of the bank in Central Europe. Well, future of the bank of Central Europe, I think it's quite easy, you know. We are moving eastward. And this is very clear. We go more to Russia, Ukraine, Central Asia, Caucasus the moment we can do it. But there is still a lot of work to be done in Central Europe. The challenge of Central Europe is I can, maybe in the LSE it's difficult to say this, but I say from a macroeconomic point of view, it's quite clear. These countries are under a huge fiscal pressure, simply to be at the level of the EU standards, to restructure the old industries like steel and so on. And so they are under constraint. What is the only way for them to reduce the constraint? The first one is the transfer from the EU, okay? And the second one, the foreign direct investment. And our challenge is to take part of the risk of the investors to go there. That's the reason why last year we have invested in Central Europe nearly 1.6 billion euro at that time. I don't know why I used the euro for Central Europe and the dollar for Central Asia.
On the last occasion that I was in Uzbekistan about 3 years ago, during the cotton harvest time, I saw the lorry loads of students and workers from Tashkent and elsewhere going into the fields to pick the cotton, because the tractors that were specially adapted for this purpose weren't available. I visited the tractor factory in Tashkent, and the equipment, which mainly came from Russia, was 90% out of order, and virtually no tractors were being manufactured. A British company was buying cotton in order to resell it in the textile mills in Ivanovo in Russia. In other words, a complete disruption of the system. Is there any sign of improvement in this? And is this an area where the EBRD is working and in a position?
Yeah, unfortunately, since then, the world price of cotton has collapsed, which is not so good for investment. And this is part of the problem. And we would prefer them to invest more in the production of vegetables and so on for the region than in cotton, for various reasons, but they do cotton. And we are ready, and we have done it in certain countries, to put in place financial facilities to buy this type of equipment. But the key point for Uzbekistan, and especially because what do they need? They need to attract foreign investment in these sectors. But you know why there's a difficulty? Because of their exchange rate system. And this is a very, very difficult discussion. Last time I was in Uzbekistan was, I think, in November. I had a long discussion with President Karimov about the exchange rate system. it's very clear, you know, it's a system. What does he say? He says, you know, I don't want my money to be used to buy chewing gum. You say, yes, okay, fine. But the impact is that you don't buy any equipment. Well, it's a good question for the central bank. I'm quite sure the Bank of England has very precise ideas and could provide assistance about what to do. What is the difficulty? Is that there are many interests built on this exchange rate system, and they have a lot of difficulties to get rid of it. And they fear to be more open. That's part of the problem. That's what I said about the window of opportunity. There is a window of opportunity now for them to move forward, to try step by step to improve their exchange rate system and to be more open. But if they don't do it, they will not be able to buy. I can tell you what I've said to President Karimov. The Uzbek economy is like a diver in the sea. It has been very, very, you know, at the bottom of the sea. And the government and the president of the country has to take the diver and to take it step by step to the surface. They are not far from the last meters, yards. But that's the most difficult decision. And I said to him, if you don't do it, the economy will be killed. If you don't bring fresh air to your economy and to your growth, there will be a bottleneck. He said to me, yes, but if you go too fast, you can also kill the diver. This is part of the problem. And I think they are exactly in that situation. But this is not a monetary discussion. It's a political discussion. And they hesitate a lot, but they haven't done it yet. He has said to me that they were making progress toward this. I hope they will, because they have a lot of potentialities. They can do a lot. They could receive money to buy this type of equipment if the investors is sure not to be trapped in the exchange rate system.
You've talked about this window of opportunity post September 11th, which suggests that it may not last very long. And that it may disappear entirely unless certain actions are taken quite promptly. I'm just wondering what sort of time frame we're talking about here, what the list of priorities for urgent action should be, and I mean, what kind of advice you would offer some of the Western governments that now have a very long-term strategic interest in these countries.
It's always difficult to tell the size of a window. I hope it's a long one. The question is not to achieve all the reforms in that window, but to start the process. And mainly there are two questions. Regional dialogue on some clear examples. And we shouldn't talk about integration. Quite sure that in London you understand that it's better not to talk about integration in the region, but to talk about trade, simply trade, fight against drug traffic, you know, common challenges, easy ones. If I mention drug, it's because the UN has taken an initiative to organize regional conference on these challenges. You know, these type of initiative are good because it will promote a dialogue between the countries and between the leaders together. But trade would be very important. And the second one is that the Western investors understand that there are good opportunities for investment there. And they are. Really, they are. And there are good opportunities simply to sell equipment, to sell coaches, trains, and so on. They are modernizing their economy, and they have resources. And we must learn the region. And the second point is certainly this one. Maybe there's a possibility also for them, but we don't have very clear ideas today, to take some benefit out of the action which will be done in Afghanistan for the rebuilding of Afghanistan. And it's clear that some of the countries of the region, those which are on the border, mainly not Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan is on the border, but especially Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, they think they could provide, you know, transport means and salmon factories and so on. So really, there can be a momentum there to help them. That's what I've mentioned as a window of opportunity. How long can it last? The longer as possible. But the countries must also understand this. It's what I mean. They must understand it.
Sorry. Excuse me. I'm just wondering if you could tell us something about your views about the increasing U.S. presence in Central Asia. Now, I'm not too familiar with the workings of the EBRD in the region, but only recently the State Department announced that they're looking to spend some $11 billion over a 10-year period in the region. You mentioned $1.8 billion spent in the region by EBRD over the last 10 years. Now, is there do you coordinate policies with the U.S. in any way, or is this an area where you could possibly clash?
Oh, clash, no. The United States is the biggest shareholder of the bank. the biggest. They have 10% of the bank. Then you have five countries with 8%. UK, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan. But you are talking about amounts, but you are not talking about the same money. The American money will be assistance. Our money is investment. It's not exactly the same. You might say I'm very happy. The more they receive cheap money, the more it is used to improve the situation, the better it will be. We have no problem. And we would like the World Bank to concentrate, be focused on the region. No, we have no difficulty. There's no conflict. And we coordinate a lot with the EU, with the American. May I add one important partner, because you mentioned the American, Japan. You may know that Japan has opened, in the books of the EBRD, June last year, a trust fund to finance institution building in Central Asia. I think they have been, before the 11th of September, Japan had understood that that was key, and they are very helpful, of course, in Central Asia.
Perhaps you could share your views with us on political succession, and related to that question, your views on the future of institutional development, institution building, which is clearly very weak throughout the whole region.
Mm-hmm. Succession, you mean? Political succession. On your second point, I do agree, and I've said it. One of their challenges is to strengthen their institutions, to build institutions and to strengthen them. We have no problem. We are very grateful to Japan for their specific focus. They put money there. And there are not so many to do this, and they have understood. And they have a lot to learn. I'll take two examples. I think the central banks are working quite well in the region. But you have a new challenge, especially in Kazakhstan, which is the relationship between the central power and the AKIMs, the regions. Why? Because some regions are very rich because of oil and gas, some are not. And they have to build the whole system. We know this quite well, you know, how to organize the repartition of revenues between the local, the municipalities and the central state and so on. It's very difficult. For instance, in Kazakhstan, we support their efforts. They have started to work on this to improve the situation. So they have everything to be done. On the political situation, there is a country which is very difficult. It's Tajikistan, because of the history of the country in the 10 last years, the civil war, and so on. But now they are more on track. On the other countries, Turkmenistan, you know the situation. Turkmenbashi is there for a certain time, at least according to the rules of the country. In the other countries, mainly Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, you have exactly the same problem as the one you have in other former CIS countries. I have in mind Azerbaijan, where you have very strong men knowing how to manage a country, being able to have a sound management open to the world, especially in Kazakhstan. But this is the previous generation. But they are not so old. It's not so. So it's a good point. It's an open question. I don't have the answer. And that's the reason why we need to talk a lot with them.
Are the aims and ambitions of the EBRD in China compatible with respect to Central Asia? If there is a conflict of interest, what responsibility does the EBRD have in managing that potential issue? And secondly...
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Are the aims and ambitions of the EBRD in China with respect to Central Asia compatible? If they're not and there is a conflict of interest with respect to those, what role does the EBRD have in managing that? And the issue of creating a regional trading bloc within that area, does that... the plans for that include the inclusion of China and the opening of borders on that side as well as with Europe?
Yeah, but I said that there is a silent partner, which is China. In fact, today, there are not many of these business relationships between Central Asia and China. They are not. But it's clear that China is interested by the region, and the region can be interested by China. But today, we don't know what is going to happen. I can tell you that for the first time in the history of the bank, we have seen a Chinese company in one of our operations for the first time before. But there can be, from my point of view, no conflict. Why? Because we invest in concrete projects, business-like. So there's no specific reason for a conflict. And but we are talking about something we don't know. That's the reason why I said that this is a silent partner today. Maybe it can be more active, maybe not. We shall see. But from my point of view, there's no reason for a conflict between them and us. There's no reason. But China is not a shareholder of EBRD. And that's good. Your second question, sorry? What point was? Today, to my knowledge, the trade relationship between the Central Asia and China are very limited, very limited. What I have said is that Central Asia would like to do this, and we can understand why, and the basis should be mainly gas and oil. What can happen after, I don't know, could develop. But it's something which doesn't exist really today, it's potential.
John, I think we should probably release you, especially given your flu condition. This has been a really fascinating evening. I think everybody will agree. You've been extremely vivid, extremely frank, and I think all of us have learned a tremendous amount, and I'm sure you've achieved your original objective that you set out, which is to make us not forget Central Asia. Thank you very, very much.
And please, do go to Central Asia. It's not difficult.
Send us.